29-16.
Good morning. I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection. Tuesday, April 5th, we are not going to be proceeding according to the agenda. We're going to be moving around a little bit on the chart, and up first is going to be House Bill 2716. So I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2716 and invite up Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to get all my stuff here ready to go.
Jan, would you give us a brief little description of House Bill 2716?
No.
If you can find it out of order.
Mm-hmm. Committee chairs and committee members, House Bill 2716, it allows cities and counties to adopt limits on the number or the density of premises that the Oregon Liquor Control Commission may license in a city, a county, or a specific area within. And it allows separate limits to be set for on-site sales, off-site sales, or brew pubs. It directs the commission to establish a waiting list for applicants who have been refused a license based on those limits.
Thank you, and good morning. Welcome to the committee this morning.
Good morning.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei. I represent House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. Thank you very much for allowing me to bring this bill before your committee today. I am the legislative representative on the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, and this is an issue that has come up very frequently in our discussions. Research clearly shows that too many alcohol outlets in a locality can be a public health and safety issue. Studies document the connection between outlet density and alcohol problems such as alcohol-fueled violence, DUIs, underage drinking, and public nuisance issues. Currently, for anyone who applies for an OLCC license and meets the minimal qualifications, the license is granted. The city or county has no way to say we already have enough places in that area to serve alcohol. House Bill 2716 will address this issue. Specifically, this bill will give local governments the authority to limit the number of alcohol retail establishments in their jurisdictions. Cities could choose to put a cap on the number of places that sell alcohol as a whole, or they could establish limits for specific areas of the city. This bill doesn't require cities to establish such limits. It merely allows those cities who want to limit the number of alcohol retail outlets to do so. I believe that you have received written testimony from some individuals from neighborhood associations dealing with some of the problems from the neighborhood perspective. And we have members here from the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission to talk more about these issues. And I want to say something about the Dash 1 Amendment. We worked with Steve Farrow, the executive director of the OLCC, on these amendments. These amendments clarify that it is the city which takes on all record-keeping responsibility for tracking the caps, and it's the city or county responsible for notifying OLCC of any changes in the caps that are made. Any extra work that it needs to be done will be done by the city or county, not by OLCC. Colleagues, we need to give our local jurisdictions a way to get a handle on the burgeoning number of alcohol retail establishments. Too much alcohol in a concentrated area has severe repercussions both for public safety and community livability. This bill gives local governments one more tool to use, and I urge you to move this bill with the Dash 1 amendments. Colleagues, I'm not sure. I think some of the letters from neighborhoods have been sent to you, and I just want to point out some of the points that they make. I've been involved with Southeast Uplift in the Portland area for some years, and this issue has become a really tough issue for them. You hear in one of the letters from a woman who lives in the Clinton Street area. As you probably know, with the urban growth boundary, especially in Portland, and I would imagine this is happening in Bend and other cities, that Salem, etc., with the urban growth boundary, what is tried to be done is to sort of get people to live in a neighborhood and to have various shops and restaurants open to people in the neighborhood so they can access those by foot or by bike. What's happened in some of these neighborhoods, and I'll use the Clinton neighborhood as an example, if any of you are familiar with that. It's in southeast Portland, and there's the Clinton Street Theater, which is a wonderful theater, wonderful restaurant area. But what's happening is that these outlet densities seem to gravitate toward one place. Once one is successful, then another will come in. Until pretty soon, that is the destination point for people who are wanting to drink. And drink to excess. So these are in neighborhoods. So the neighbors are bothered by cars driving on their property, their property being used as a toilet, dropping off drug paraphernalia. It's really, and these are middle-class neighborhoods. And when the bars are out at 2 o'clock, that's when a lot of this activity is exacerbated. I'm hoping that you'll be hearing from some of the people in neighborhoods. We heard from them in the Judiciary Committee when we heard a similar bill. So what's happened then in these denser neighborhoods, we're trying to make more facilities available for people, for shopping, for restaurants, etc. When these bars and restaurants, when they come in, and they're a good money-making business, so it's great for the bar owner or the tavern owner, etc. But what happens is that some of the other businesses leave. So it's no longer available for the kind of businesses that the neighbors would like to walk to. And there are some studies that have been done, and I'll just read you some of the materials from those studies. When outlet density increases, alcohol consumption increases, and vice versa. This was found in 16 years of data in Canada. Reducing off-premises density was significantly associated with a decrease in alcohol consumption. Alcohol density is the single greatest predictor of violent crime in neighborhoods, greater than any other social or economic factor. One study found that reducing violent crime by 1% could be achieved by reducing alcohol outlet density by less than 1%. Adolescent binge drinking and driving after drinking have been significantly associated with the presence of alcohol retailers within a block of one's home. And this one is very significant. Hispanic youth who live farther from alcohol retailers are less likely to drink. This is one study found that by decreasing the distance to retailers, that's significantly associated with an increase in alcohol consumption, even when controlling for social and environmental factors. So, colleagues, this is a neighborhood issue. And I'll read you one more thing, and then I will let other people testify. I hope I can find it.
Thank you, Representative. We do have a pretty long list today.
All right.
And I appreciate your testimony, and we've got the information you supplied us, and I'm sure we'll be able to look over all this information.
Thank you. Any questions before I leave? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next up, I have Tony Biglin, Mary Ellen Glenn, and unfortunately, I'm going to have to limit you to about 2 minutes apiece. So make your points quick and concise. Welcome, and if you'd identify yourself for the record, please. Thank you.
My name is Anthony Biglin. I'm a senior scientist at Oregon Research Institute and director of the Promise Neighborhood Research Consortium. I've distributed one thing which describes the Promise Neighborhood Research Consortium. We have a team of people around the country who've been working on policies and have created fact sheets which you can find on our website. We have about 50 policies. I want to highlight one of them, which is on this sheet, called the value of alcohol outlet densities. Tobacco and blood pressure account for a significant amount of disease and disability, but the third highest factor contributing to disability and mortality is, in fact, alcohol use. It's higher than cholesterol, body mass index, physical activity, or drug use. And so reducing both the violence and illness due to alcohol use is an important public health issue. I would point to the list of achievable results that policies regarding controlling the density of alcohol outlets produces. There are large, significant reductions in alcohol consumption. Let me explain mean elasticity. Mean elasticity is the degree to which a decrease in the outlet density would decrease problems. An elasticity of 0.27, the alcohol consumption would be reduced by 0.27, means that if there were a 10% reduction in the alcohol outlet density, then it would reduce consumption by about 2.7%. Similarly, there would be significant reductions in interpersonal violence and reductions in unintentional injury. And small reductions in crime. And so reducing the number of outlets, it would have a significant impact. And I want to emphasize that there is really an enormous amount of research on this, so it's a pretty solid scientific finding.
Thank you. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. My name is Mary Ellen Glynn. I'm with the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. I'm here in support of this bill. I just want to give you one scary statistic. The number of Oregon eighth graders who have had a drink in the past, alcoholic drink, in the past month is twice the national average, 28% in Oregon compared to about 15% nationwide. That is, in many cases, due to availability and prevalence of alcohol. It's all over the place. And you've just heard Professor Biglin talk about limiting alcohol outlet density and what that does. We believe that House Bill 2716 can address this issue basically so that local communities can decide based on the data in their community whether they should limit the number of outlets and the number of places where young people can get alcohol. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and I want to try to keep our questions to a minimum unless you have something you really feel these people need to answer. I think the issues are pretty well laid out. We've got a pretty full agenda today. I appreciate your testimony, and I will note that, Mary Ellen, you're with the Alcohol and Drug
Policy Commission, yes.
Policy Commission, and so the Policy Commission has taken a position on this bill?
In favor of it, yes.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to make sure I heard that. Thank you very much for your testimony today. I appreciate it. Next up, I'd like to have Barshad Aladadi. Excuse me if I don't do this very well. Steve Moore, Philadelphia. I don't know. Taylor Fallon. Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Holvey.
And again, you got about 2 minutes apiece. So.
For the record, my name is Farshad Aladadi. I'm the Director of License Services with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. House Bill 2716 allows cities and counties to adopt limits on the number or density of premises within a city or county or within specific areas of a city or county that OLCC may license for alcohol sales or service. OLCC shares and supports the community's interests in constantly improving public safety. OLCC understands the desires for local governments to control the total number of liquor licenses operating within their community. We are concerned that House Bill 2716 would be too restrictive in scope by allowing these limits to be set by certain geographical areas. The OLCC commissioners chose not to support this bill at their February meeting, citing concerns that these limits could lead to arbitrary liquor licensing decisions throughout the state and undermine statewide consistency. The burden of tracking these limits would also be a concern. Although the proposed amendments do relieve some of the commission's concerns with tracking, we believe the responsibility to track should reside with local governments if they choose to adopt these limits, not with the OLCC. Tracking these non-uniform limits would be a resource strain as we do not currently have the infrastructure to support them. The OLCC's mission is to balance public safety and economic growth. We look forward to continuing our outreach efforts to foster positive relationships with licensees and the communities they serve. We would not want non-uniform limits to unduly impact Oregon's ability to maintain strong job growth in these difficult times. Limit the entrepreneurial spirit of people seeking to start businesses. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. If we could get the next test fire,
yes,
please.
My name is Steve Moore. I own Philadelphia Steaks and Hoagies, and that was a very nice segue. I moved here in 1974 with $30 in a backpack, and I went into business for myself, and I've lived the American dream. I own have three liquor licenses. I'm buying two buildings, commercial properties to run my business out of. And in other states where they limit liquor licenses, they go for tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that would have effectively blocked me out of living my dream. So now if it does pass and the value goes up, I've got a lot of value in those three liquor licenses. So I personally stand to gain, but I'm not here today for myself because I've got mine. But I'm here today for my 25-year-old staff who is trying to get ahead in their lives and still see those opportunities out there. So I urge you to be careful about that. We can see there's problems with alcohol, but I'm not sure that this would solve them. There's nothing to take someone from buying a liquor license, moving it, expanding the location, tripling the size of the location if the demand is there, because the demand will be met, I believe. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Kara?
Yeah, Kara Thallon. This is Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association. I had child care issues, so Kara got here before than I did. But for the record, Bill Perry, we're opposed to this measure, and basically when you look at the fundamental questions I think that are trying to be addressed here is, does this help control alcohol? And I do not believe it does. It doesn't help sales to minors. It doesn't help the sales to visibly intoxicated. And if you look just at a couple of extreme examples, I drive through the representative that introduced this bill, their district, almost every day. You drive up 99, you go through Oregon City, Gladstone, Milwaukee, and Portland. And so if Milwaukee banned liquor license, is this going to accomplish anything in those urban areas? They just got to move a couple of blocks down. You're going to have licenses open up. So it's not going to control the sale of alcohol in an urban area. Now, to Mr. Moore's point, you take an extreme example, I would say, like over at Sun River. If you put a quota on the sale of or in new liquor licenses in Sun River, if demand goes up, those establishments are just going to expand. If you have a problem establishment today and you ban liquor licenses in that community, you've made that problem establishment, the value of their business, increase because he can no longer have any competitors. So if you're trying to get a bad establishment, I just don't believe this even comes close to addressing the problem. And it takes away the overall look at how you control liquor licenses, and it starts to just have these different segments. So if you want to control liquor licenses, you have to look at it in a global view and try to do something that punishes bad actors, not increase the value of their business. So with that, I'd like to close and answer any questions if you need.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and not seeing any questions. Thank you very much. Next up, I have Mayor Peterson, Scott Winkle.
That's my name.
And Tom Parker. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Good morning, co-chairs Hovey and Wisnett, and honorable members of the committee. I am Anna Peterson. I'm the mayor of Salem, and I'm very much want to thank you for holding the hearing on House Bill 2716 and providing us with this opportunity to come and voice our support for the bill. I want to also point out that I do support jobs. I'm wearing my job button. I've been wearing this job button ever since Chuck Bennett got it and gave it to me. And I've been a strong proponent as a volunteer for economic development for a number of years. So I want to make that very clear. But I also want to say that the Salem City Council members carefully considered this legislation, and we've taken a position in support of the bill along with several similar bills that would provide local governments with a tool to help control the problems associated with an over-concentration of alcohol establishments. Because we are elected officials and because we are so close to our constituents, we often hear from neighborhood associations, from business groups, from constituents about problem areas throughout the community. Areas where alcohol is too easily available and concentrated, creating what we call hot spots for public safety issues. This bill provides a tool that would be available to local governments to decide to use or not that would help deal with these situations. It would allow local governments to request from OLCC the ability to place limits on the number or density of establishments selling alcohol. This would provide us with more influence on the liquor licensing process. Again, thank you for the opportunity to come today and to support this bill. It provides us with an important tool to respond to the needs in our community, and we ask that you take action to pass this bill out to the floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Morning. Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, for the records, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in favor of House Bill 2716. As an Intergovernmental Relations Associate for the League of Oregon Cities, I participated on the OLCC's Saturation Task Force. There were numerous long meetings held at the OLCC headquarters, and what the task force eventually determined was that, one, the statutes weren't that there was a saturation problem within parts of the state, that the statutes weren't sufficient to address the saturation issue, and nor could a statewide or a cookie cutter saturation approach be taken by the agency. There's we heard some testimony earlier in regards to inconsistency. From the League of Oregon City's perspective, inconsistency isn't necessarily a bad thing. This is what this bill would do, was allow local city councils who have the best idea of what's going, the best picture of what's going on in their communities, to make the decisions and say enough is enough. Cities in this state are preempted from both regulating the consumption of alcohol in any significant manner and preempted from taxing alcohol that will allow us to recoup our public safety costs. While cities do get shared revenue from alcohol from the sale of alcohol and from the beer and wine taxes, the amount of money cities receive does not compensate cities for the costs associated with the public safety implications of alcohol consumption. One injury or fatality DUI wreck can cost 40 hours of police time, and most of that's going to be OT. With that, I'll close and be meager for your questions.
Thank you. Good morning. Can you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, good morning, Chairs Holvey and Wisnett. My name is Tom Parker. I'm the Communications Director for Oregon Partnership. We're a nonprofit that fights alcohol and drug abuse. And in that light, we are always in favor of anything that limits the opportunity for alcohol abuse. This is not a ban. This has to do with density, which is a big difference. And the concept here that's being rung in is that this is something best decided on the local level, because everybody knows their neighborhoods far better than at least me. I'll try to limit this down and get to my main points here. The science behind limiting outlet density really is supported by a number of issues, not the least of which the folks at the Centers for Disease Control say that there's a definite correlation here. And they are very much in favor of using regulatory authority. In other words, either by having outlet density limited on the basis of sufficient evidence of a positive association between that density and excessive alcohol consumption and related harms. What this boils down to is You've got a combination of neighborhoods needing to be able to decide what's there. You've got a stress on law enforcement trying to follow up. And it's the clustering of alcohol outlets in a small area that creates problems, especially difficult for enforcement in those areas. And really, Oregon has no real limit currently on outlets. As a matter of fact, it's increasing at a pretty strong rate. So as that increases, so does the burden on local law enforcement. And with budget cuts, that's going to make it tougher for them to do compliance checks with regularity that's necessary to protect underage drinkers. This law allows local communities to decide what those limits are. And that's really appropriate because each one has their own special needs. Some communities, for example, Newport, where they've got a significant tourist business, are going to need more outlets. Smaller residential communities are going to need less. And this bill would give local citizens a measure of control over their own communities by providing a tool to curtail problems with alcohol abuse. So, members of the committee, it's our strong suggestion that you support this bill, 2617. We do. Thank you.
Thank
2716.
You.
I'll read the right number. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it this morning. Next, Representative Smith.
They've already stood up.
Okay. Good enough. Next up, I have Alan Tresider.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. Alan Tresider, representing the Northwest Grocery Association. We oppose House Bill 2716 for many of the reasons that my colleague from the Restaurant and Lodging Association stated. We have over 600 grocery stores in Oregon. What we need is consistency in rules and law that tell us what the rules are going to be from city to city. And as we're sending out alcohol to our various stores, I don't want to have a truck say, well, you can stop in Milwaukee, but you can't stop in it's very important that we have a consistent statewide policy. This bill is arbitrary from city to city, community to community. As previous spokesmen have noted, I noted my colleague from the League of Orient City talked about being on the density task force at OLCC, and I think it's important that many of us participated in that, and yet the OLCC is opposed to this bill because it doesn't do what you all think it might do, what the proponents think it would do. I think it's clear that if demand increased in your limited number of the license, that existing stores and licensees would simply expand to address that need. So alcohol abuse is a serious problem in this state, but this bill does not address that problem. And so on behalf of the grocers of the state, we'd hope you'd keep the OLCC as the administrator of these programs and not let individual jurisdictions adopt restrictive rules and regulations. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Next up, I have Stephanie Soares Plump. Good morning and welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm Stephanie Suarez Pump. I am the chair of the Prevention Committee for the Oregon Prevention, Education, and Recovery Association. I've submitted written testimony, so I won't address all those points, but I did want to address a couple of major points. I typically testify before the Human Services Committees in both the House and the Senate and Ways and Means. And those legislators are always talking to us about what are the outcomes and what are the impacts and what differences are being made. And I'm here to tell you, in fact, I will turn this in as well, although I don't have copies for everyone. There are 21 citations of research. And if we want to look at evidence-based practice in our state, which this body has taken a public policy stand on two sessions ago, and we've been focusing on evidence-based research ever since, this is a classic evidence-based practice. Density is an issue, and it does have positive outcomes in preventing violence, underage use, adult abuse, etc. I can't stress enough what an important step it would be for us to institute this kind of a policy. The second point I'd like to make is, it's ironic, is classic local control, which this state has prided itself on. For a community and elected officials in those communities to say, we have enough or we don't have enough, is a local decision. I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I really appreciate you coming forward today, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
Oh, that's all right. I'm used to that one. One they don't pronounce and one they don't believe. So,
so with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2716. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2916. Jan, would you give us a brief little description of House Bill 2916, please?
Mr. Chairs and committee members, 2916 directs a lender to offer the borrowers the option to pay the residual debt on a short sale at the same amount or at a discount that the lender would offer. Specifies conditions for the offer and the acceptance of the offer, and it provides that a violation of the provisions is an unlawful trade practice, declares an emergency effective on passage. And you have a dash one amendment before you, which deletes all provisions relating to the residual debt in the printed bill. It will prohibit a lender from bringing action or otherwise seeking payment for the residual debt on a residential short sale if the lender's reported to the IRS that all or some of the residual debt has been canceled. That's it.
Thank you. And I see one person signed up for this bill, and they're not at the table. But since you're up there, go ahead, please. Introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Wingard. I'm State Representative from House District 26. And first of all, let me tell you that the amendment basically replaces the bill. So what was just described to you that the bill does is not exactly correct, and I will explain it. I think I brought before you today a bill you all can get very excited about. It is extremely timely. All of us have constituents in our district who have been involved in the foreclosure and short sale of their home due to the housing crisis. And I know we've all been looking for a way to help those folks, and I think you have it before you today. This was originally brought to me as a concept, the bill you have before you, by my constituent, John Bacon, who is a realtor on the front lines watching the wreckage that has been going on for the last couple of years. Ultimately, I asked the realtors and the bankers to get and the lenders to get together and to try to work out something that everybody could live with and that moved the ball on this. And I think they really did do exactly that. So currently, when there is a foreclosure and a short sale, there are two options that can be followed. Lenders can take the write-off on the loss from the short sale. When they do that, they issue a federal tax form 1099 to the former owner and usually send a letter that explains that they took a write-off on the short sale and won't be seeking repayment from the homeowner who defaulted. Alternately, the lender can attempt to recoup their losses from the homeowner through debt collection. The problem with the current law and the rationale for the bill is that there is a window in which the lender can revise their taxes and attempt to recoup their loss through debt collection, even after they sent that form and perhaps that letter. This causes a problem because the borrower is generally operating under the understanding that they have had their debt extinguished through the previous action. The amended bill before you, if it is amended, it forces lenders to make a choice. They can either write off the loss and send the federal tax form 1099, or they can attempt debt collection on the borrower. But once the choice is made, they are unable to backtrack and surprise borrowers with collection demands at a later date. The dash one amendments that I'm hoping you all have in front of you were reached through work between Paul Cosgrove from the Oregon Bankers Association and Sean Dillians from the Oregon Association of Realtors. And I want to thank them both because they've been working on this for weeks, and I'm really pleased with the result. The amendments are a collaborative effort, and all parties are satisfied that it provides excellent consumer protection while giving businesses the correct amount of leeway to operate in today's environment. This change in the law does not protect the high-income person who is looking to simply write off a bad investment in a house. It protects the average family who has already gone through a foreclosure and a short sale, and it lets them know that the process is done. And with that, I have brought the two that did the negotiation. They're here to answer your questions, and I hope that at this point you are as excited about this bill as I am. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the testimony. And would you like to provide any testimony?
Sure. Thank you.
Could you introduce yourself?
Thank you, please? Chair Holvey and Co-Chair Wisnett. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, in support of 2916 and the Dash 1 amendments. And I would echo Representative Wingert's comments in that we actually are very excited to have this bill before you. It was one of our members who brought the idea to him originally, and it's something that we've seen throughout the state. And just to give a little bit, because I think most people think they know what a short sale is, but just to inform the committee what it actually is, it's where the borrower who's in their home is selling the house for less than is owed on it. Unfortunately, we're seeing more and more folks underwater in their homes, and they can't afford the payments anymore, and a short sale provides a vehicle for them to avoid foreclosure. It can sometimes be more beneficial on their credit, although they should consult an attorney for that, but it also benefits the community because you don't go through the process of having that foreclosure there, the home being vacant. You have a willing buyer who's there who's going to typically move into the property. And so we've been working for ways to try and encourage short sales and provide some certainty there. The issue that we were seeing, though, was in the short sale, there is a deficiency that exists because they're selling for less, and folks were confused about what their obligations were going forward after they conducted the short sale. And we had one particular example in Bend where an individual was going to conduct a short sale, went to two different attorneys, and of course got three different opinions on what the impact was. Mr. Cosgrove and I make fun of ourselves all the time for that reason, but there was a lot of confusion because the bank was saying, well, we're going to issue a 1099-C, so you're off the hook, and some attorneys were saying, well, no, you're not off the hook, because they could come back. This bill with the Dash 1 amendment clarifies that and says, in a short sale, once a 1099-C is issued, that's it. Lender, you're off the hook. You can move on with your life, try and rebuild your credit, and get back on track. Yes. Get back on track.
Everything out.
Can I interrupt for a second? Do we have the Dash 1 amendments?
Committee members, they're on the S drive. If you have looked on your S drive, if not, we have paper copies in the hearing room.
That'd be great.
So, Mr. Cosgrove, would you like to give some testimony?
Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Bankers Association. I don't need to add anything further. I think both these two have adequately and correctly described the intent of the bill and our position as well as to support it with a Dash 1. Thank you.
So I noticed that the realtors supported 2916 and the Dash 1, and you're just supporting the Dash 1. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, the Dash 1 deletes the whole bill and replaces it, so I think we're saying the same thing.
And I would clarify that too, Mr. Chair. I think what you have before you in the Dash 1 is a great bill. The part of the bill that remains is the definition section, which is important to keep that in there.
So you're not supporting the original bill then?
I think there are concerns with the original bill, which is why we worked for several months now coming to something that would work, that wouldn't encourage.
Appreciate your testimony. Yeah. Thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. It is a big issue in this state. I do know that. So with that, up next, I'd like to have John Bacon come up.
I don't think he feels the need to testify. I think he's here just to encourage you all to pass the bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2916. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3461. Jan, would you please give us a description of House Bill 3461?
Is Harker here?
Yeah, he's here.
Harker's here.
3461, please.
Excuse me. Committee chairs and committee members, House Bill 3461 requires a surcharge that Pacific Corps collects from customers to recover costs to remove Klamath dams be spread across all customer classes on an equal percentage basis. Requires Pacific Corps to revise the surcharge amount to account for changes in the customer load. Requires Pacific Corps to refund any surcharges collected in excess of what's needed to remove the dams, any surcharges that are collected inappropriately, and all surcharges if the resulting rates were found to not be fair, just, or reasonable. Requires Pacific Corps to stop collecting the surcharge if one or more dams are not removed and refund to customers any excess amounts remaining in the trust accounts. Requires Pacific Corps to stop collecting the surcharge and refund to customers all amounts collected if California does not provide its portion of the funds by January 2013.
Thank you. With that, I apologize. I didn't see Representative Harker in the audience. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3461 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3291 and call up Representative Harker, and we'll get back to 3461 after this.
Good morning. Sorry to cause you to shift gears.
Thank you, though.
I think there is someone else signed up to present as well. Do we know about that?
Would you like to, excuse me, I wasn't paying attention to what you said, so try again.
No comment. Thank you, Chairs Holby and Wisman and members of the committee for having me here this morning. I believe that there is someone else signed up to testify as well, but if they are not yet here, I will go along and you can get back on your schedule and they will appear when they do. Someone from Secretary of State may or may not be here, but I do know that I am Representative Chris Harker from House Bill 34, which is Beaverton and Cedar Hills, including other areas. And I thank you for letting me speak to House Bill 3291. Members, as you might have noticed from its length, it is a short and simple bill, but an important one that strengthens existing mechanisms intended to hold state agencies accountable. Accountability is a word we hear often and something that we are striving to do a better job at here. And I, along with the other sponsors of this bill, believe that this would go a significant way towards that. At its core, it seeks to ensure that agencies are continually improving to serve the public interest. We have multiple mechanisms in Oregon to make sure the government is doing its job. For those of us in the legislative branch, we have elections. Those guarantee that we are accountable to the people. If constituents don't think that we serve their interests, they certainly have an avenue for redress. For state agencies, the audit is the parallel accountability measure. But audits are useless without follow-through, just as elections would be useless if we didn't tabulate the results and remove the folks who had been rejected by their constituents. I'm currently serving as co-chair of the committee with the longest name, the Joint Committee on Legislative Audits and Information Management and Technology. One of our goals there is to ensure that agencies are complying with the findings of their audits. So we are reviewing some of the audits conducted by the Secretary of State. However, we are necessarily being somewhat selective due to the number of audits conducted and the restrictions on our time. Our task would be a good deal easier and our likelihood of success a good deal greater if we were to pass House Bill 3291. I hope that you will help us close this loop and make state government more accountable.
Thank you, Representative Harker. I appreciate the testimony and not seeing any questions of you today. I appreciate that, and I do know we have a couple, at least some other folks to testify on the bill.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, Barry Pack and Glenn Spain.
Excuse me, Mr. Co-Chair. I was to testify in 3461, but we went by that very quickly.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not testifying on this bill, Glenn Spain.
Good enough. Got signed up on the wrong sheet. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State, and I will be brief. I know you've got a long agenda. We're here to support House Bill 3291. We're always looking for ways that we can encourage state agencies to implement the recommendations of our audits. There are a number of ways we do that now through a follow-up audit, as we are currently engaged in at the Willamette Education Service District. Personal and direct contact with the Secretary of State and a state agency head is often another way to encourage implementation of our findings, and frankly, a more persuasive evidence-based audit report that garners agency buy-in at the end of the process is one of the most helpful ways that we can ensure that agencies are able to implement our recommendations. House Bill 3291 presents another method, which is reporting directly to lawmakers and the public. I think this gives state agencies a number of opportunities. First, they can highlight the steps they've taken to implement our recommendations, and they can also highlight any barriers or obstacles they have. Maybe it's a lack of resources, competing priorities, or other obstacles, and they can raise those directly with the folks who are empowered to help remove those barriers. And then third, there are times, and we hope they are rare, where agencies flat out disagree with our findings. We do our best to address that in the final stages of the audit, but the fact remains that occasionally disagreements do happen, and this bill would give agencies the opportunity to share that perspective with lawmakers. We stand by our findings and are more than willing to defend them publicly, but there are times when policy choices must be made, and in many instances, it's the legislature that needs to set that policy. So finally, we've been asked in the past about the possibility of simply mandating in statute that agencies implement our recommendations, but we could not do that without compromising our audit independence under the generally accepted government auditing standards set out by the Government Accountability Office. So we think this is a great alternative. It's a win-win for everyone, for our office, for lawmakers, state agencies, and perhaps most importantly for the public. And with that, I urge your support and would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much for that explanation. It looks like a pretty short bill and yet a pretty important one, so I appreciate you taking the time and providing us your testimony today.
Okay, thanks very much.
Not seeing anyone else signed up, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3291. And I'm going to skip to House Joint Memorial 10 with a few people to testify on that before we move on to 3461. So with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 10. Can you give us a brief description of House Joint Memorial 10?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the memorial urges Congress to enact legislation that assists the FDIC and the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund in establishing a voluntary system of full insurance for public funds accounts and allows states to discard state-specific public fund collateralization. There are no amendments.
Thank you, and we have a representative from Representative Bernhardt's office, I know, would like to speak on this bill. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you.
If you identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and Co-Chair Wisnant. For the record, my name is Sonia Carlson, Chief of Staff to Representative Phil Bernhardt, who could not attend this morning because he's co-chairing the Revenue Committee. HJM 10 evolved out of a discussion Representative Bernhardt hosted with our local community bankers. We hosted this meeting to find out in what ways the state could help boost the economy and stimulate job production in Oregon. While Oregon's ability to jumpstart the economy in a global economic recession is limited, once the recovery is underway, we can make sure that our public resources give us the most bang for each buck. HJM 10 is an effort to prepare for the recovery. HJM 10 urges Congress to enact legislation to assist the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund to establish a voluntary system to insure public funds. Currently, banks and credit unions accepting public fund deposits are required to collateralize these funds above the worth of the insurance. This means that holding public funds actually costs our local depositories resources they could use to make loans and help get Oregonians back to work. I urge you to send HJM 10 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your explanation of the bill. With that, I'd like to call up Michael Savaggio and Kevin Christensen. Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer, and we bring you, through Representative Barnhart, House Joint Memorial 10, which, as was explained, currently public deposits in the state of Oregon, whether they be in local banks, larger banks, credit unions, need to be collateralized above the insured amount. And what that does is that essentially locks up those funds from local lending, because that money is then in securities, bonds, that sort of thing. And I have Kevin Christensen here from the OBA who can talk more about the technical aspects of that. What we seek to do through the federal action recommended by House Joint Memorial 10 is to establish a higher tier of insurance among the FDIC and National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund. That would essentially be a larger pool, a more efficient way of collateralizing those deposits and unlock the billions of dollars that we have locked out of Oregon lending. So with that, I'll just mention to the committee that the FDIC is almost 80 years old, and in that time it has not lost a dollar of insured accounts. So we see this as a very secure, very efficient, very reasonable step to take to begin unfreezing Oregon's credit markets and putting more of this money back into the economy. So we urge your passage of this memorial to the floor, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Christensen.
Thank you.
And Chair Holby and Chair Wisnant, thanks for the opportunity to testify. I'm Kevin Christensen with the Oregon Bankers Association, and we are in support of House Joint Memorial 10. I've had the committee administrators circulate a quick four-page summary, kind of a crib sheet with respect to Oregon's Public Deposit Protection Program. This is something that our President, Linda Navarro, put together earlier this year. She did run it past Darren Bond in the Treasurer's Office just to get a check mark to make sure she wasn't going too far off the reservation, but it's more of a factual sheet that kind of describes the evolution of our current public deposit protection program. As some of our other panelists have testified, there is concern right now with the fact that until recently public funds had to be collateralized at 100%. That was recently, I believe within the last month or two, reduced to 75%. But what that means essentially is that banks holding public funds have to hold at least at the 100% a dollar for every dollar that they're taking in for public funds, and again, that creates disincentives for banks as far as being able to turn those funds around and lend them out in the community to help with growth. What we're looking, what we're supporting here is, as Mr. Salvaggio indicated, urging Congress to come up with a program that allows FDIC to create a means, a voluntary means of insuring those uninsured public funds, similar to what happens right now. FDIC limits secure accounts up to $250,000, where we would be seeking Congress to, through our delegation, our congressional delegation, to devise a program. FDIC is pretty complex, as I understand it. Right now, there is not pending legislation. However, it's my understanding that the Treasurer's Office has been in communications with our delegation trying to formulate a procedure. One other quick note I would add, and this is kind of more of a nationwide issue, each state has a little bit different program as to how they go about collateralizing their funds. And one consequence, positive consequences of this, is it could serve to uniform, create some more uniformity how different states use and secure their public funds. So with that, we do urge the support of the bill, and would urge you to pass it out without on a due pass basis. Well, I'll answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony, and thanks for your support of the bill. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Joint Memorial 10 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3461. since we already had a description of the bill, hopefully we can remember some of it. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm sponsoring this bill on behalf of consumers in Oregon and jobs. I was made aware of this situation. Members of the body of the committee who were here last session know that this was an important bill that we passed last session. And this bill, committee members, we're still working on it. We were supposed to have a work group yesterday, and we couldn't get the group together. The work group consists of Pacific Corp, the Public Utilities Commission, CUB, Citizens Utility Board, the Treasurer's Office, and Mr. Nelson, who represents Northwest Industry Consumers of the Power. So the co-chair, Hovey, agreed to go ahead and have the public hearing to start get you up to speed. I think this is an important bill. I see the governor's office has come on board now is opposing it. We'll hear from that. But I wanted to give you as much information as we could to start the discussion. You're invited to the work group meeting tomorrow to look into this. The thing that got me real interested and enthusiastic about supporting it, we can help consumers. We can help create jobs because we're proposing lowering the rates for consumers, industry consumers. Then I found out that your money, the consumer's money, is being invested in money market. $16 million the first year will create in this fund, and it's going into a money market. So you'll hear a couple things about the bill that we do have some amendments that we're proposing. We've worked with the Treasurer's Office that we can still protect the money to either remove the dam or re-license the dam. And I'm willing to bet anyone on the committee that I'll even probably give you odds. It's probably the chances of the dam being destroyed is probably like the Final Four teams we had. Unbelievable. So
North Carolina?
No, they didn't make it. But with that, Mr. Chair, I would have welcomed the testimony that we're going to hear and hope the committee will see how important this bill is.
A lot of people in the room, but I have a very short list for sign up on this at this point. So, Mark Nelson. Morning, if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Co-Chair Hovey and Co-Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson. I represent industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. As Representative Wisnett has outlined, this is a bill that was Senate Bill 76 in the last session to deal with the Klamath River basin issues. We did reach an agreement during that session with Pacific Corps and CUB regarding the original Senate Bill 76 after it came over from the Senate. We had some concerns about liability issues once the dams were removed and sediment was unearthed as to how much liability Oregon customers would receive and would have to pay for. We did reach an agreement on that issue with Pacific Corps. Since that time, there have been some additional issues that have come up. One is the PUC did allocate a rate spread between residential customers and industrial customers, and that has become an issue, and we are investigating with the State Treasury and the Public Utility Commissioner as to a way in terms of investment earnings and load growth that might be resolved. That discussion is continuing. We do have some amendments, but that there are some disagreement between the Treasury and the PUC that we're going to meet with today at 10:30, and then the PUC Commission will discuss it again at 11:30. So we ask for your indulgence while we try to work through those issues. There are also other issues dealt with in the bill. We think we can simplify those, but we do have disagreement between Pacific Corps and ourselves, and I believe CUB on that language as well. So again, we're asking for your indulgence. The reason why there aren't a lot more witnesses because people decided for me to come up and sort of explain where we are in the process, and that we'll come back to you as if and when we have agreement.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. I guess we'll be looking for some more amendments at some point. I do have a few others to testify.
Sure. I think, Mr. Nelson, if you can confirm for the committee that the PUC set a higher rate for industry than they did consumers, and the way I understand it, if you can correct me or comment on that, the PUC plans to make that right at the end of the process, which is what did we say, 2020 or 2030 or 2040 or 2050. But the problem is those industries need, you know, the lower rate now, they could be doing better and not going under, and that's why we brought forth the bill. Is that not one of the key points?
Representative Hovey and Representative Wisnett, that is correct. And industry feels very strongly that these continued rate increases, if the dams are not going to be removed, at some point that they be returned or to industry and other consumers in the state, and to be used by those industries to further job growth and the economy. Of course, everyone has an idea as to when and if and when these dams are going to be removed and what the proper time. The bill does outline a process by, if the dams are not going to be removed, the money would then be used for relicensing. So at some point, either direction, industry and other consumers will be paying. The issue is when, and is it proper to continue to collect that surcharge going forward for the next 10 years or 9 years.
Mr. Chair, one other question.
Representative Wisnett.
Because I think another thing the committee needs to realize is we have disagreement, I guess, sir, with the Treasurer's Office, but the Treasurer's Office has been at the table working with us, because the committee members need to know that was one of the issues, too, is that we had all the money, which is $16 million a year, going into money market, and the Treasurer's Office is trying to work with us to be sure that we get a better return on our money, which could lower the rates for consumers and industry. Is that correct?
Representative Holby and Representative Wisnett, that is correct. It's an effort rather than to increase residential rates, which is what the bill calls for. Is there something we can do with load growth and earnings to try to equalize between industry and residential that load growth? And quite frankly, it doesn't appear we're there yet.
Thank you. Appreciate the testimony. Next up, I have Glenn Spain and Jeff Bissonnette. Is Richard Whitman still here?
Their opposition dropped.
Is this on?
Good morning. Good morning. Can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
For the record, my name is Glenn Spain. I'm Northwest Regional Director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, PCFFA. We are the largest trade association of commercial fishing families in the West Coast. We are also one of the parties in the Klamath Settlement Agreement, and we are also one of the parties and interveners in the PUC rate-setting case, which resulted from SB 76. So we have been very much involved in this whole process for some years. I do have written testimony, and I won't bore you with going over that in detail, but I do want to hit a few high points, and that is that we see the bill as basically unnecessary for the most part, with one possible exception, which I'll get to in the end. But nearly every issue that is being raised in the bill was raised and briefed and researched, and there were witnesses and cross-examination at the PUC proceeding. Really what you come down to is the bill is an effort by ICNU to overturn the PUC's finding that the rate structure as is, as called for under SB 76, is fair, just, and reasonable, and in the best interests of Pacific Corps customers. Many of our members are also Pacific Corps customers, so we have a stake in that issue as well. One of the things that I think is bad policy here is to overturn the PUC decisions. The PUC is the constitutionally created entity to have the expertise to make these decisions. They did discuss each and every one of these issues that ICNU is raising in its bill, and for very good reasons. And I would refer anybody who wants to find out a little more detail to read that decision. For very good reasons, decided that either it was impractical or it is already being done and therefore unnecessary, or it would be unfair to other ratepayers, including residential customers. So I don't think that the provisions in the bill as introduced, many of them are even necessary, and some of them are counterproductive. In addition, there are some provisions, hopefully accidentally there, but they would restrict and legislatively limit the climate settlement agreement itself. There are more than 40 parties. Two state governors signed it. Many state and federal agencies are part of it. Many stakeholders. Most of the irrigated agricultural interests in the Upper Basin were party to the settlement. There are some very carefully crafted provisions in that agreement and carefully crafted deadlines with some flexibility for meeting those deadlines, because we don't know what may happen over the next 9 years with certainty. Many of those provisions would be disrupted by some of the deadlines in the bill language that's being introduced. I think that also is bad policy. We do not want to disable a settlement of some of the worst and most contentious water issues and power issues that have existed in our state for so long, much less the rest of the West Coast. This is one of the most bitterly fought, difficult negotiations over the last 10 years that I was part of all of that, and we really need to respect that agreement in a variety of ways, so not to disrupt it or disable it. There are a couple of provisions that are essentially poison pill provisions in there, and those have to come out. Now, the last issue, and I'm not party and haven't been party to the various negotiations involved, but the last issue is the investment issue. Now, we take no position on that. We do not oppose or accept, we essentially have no position on that. But I do want to point out that there is concern, and this is concerns also that the state treasurer has. When you invest in anything in the market, as we have seen bitterly in the last few years, markets go down, investments collapse. We've lost other trust funds, for instance, the tuition security trust fund lost something like 40% of its value because it invested in those markets just before they collapsed. We need to be very careful. Yes, we do need to invest that in something better than money market if we can. But we need to have very careful sidebars that we don't allow investment in anything that essentially increases risk unduly of losses, because right now there is no mechanism for recapturing those losses. We could wind up in a situation where we invest that, have losses, and then have to go back to those same ratepayers, including the industrial ratepayers, to make up the difference. And that is not something we want to be getting into. So my only caution there, again, we have no position formally on that, but my only caution is we tread lightly on the authority to invest in market-based securities and things of that nature.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities. I just basically wanted to come up and say we are taking part in the discussions around this bill. We're certainly open to the discussions around higher yield for the money. We do tend to be somewhat risk averse. We want to make sure that ratepayers' money is not unduly endangered, and we also want to make sure that when the ratepayer funds are required for payments of various expenses as part of the agreement, that the money is there and that ratepayers aren't on the hook for additional funds. We are taking a very wary look at some of the rate reallocation issues. There was a lot of discussion about them last session. There was a tremendous amount of discussion at the, about those at the PUC. We're actively involved in the conversations around this bill, and we'll see where we are when the bill comes back to you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. I'm not seeing any questions for you at this point. So with that, committee, I think I do need to read into the, not read into the record, but just note we did receive electronic testimony from Greg Addington in opposition to the bill and the amendments from the Klamath Water Users Association. And if people wish to get a copy of that, they can get it from the committee administrator, who now has it as well, at some point. So with that, I appreciate your testimony, and I apologize.
Against the amendments, they haven't been released yet.
Well, we do have a dash one and a dash two amendment, but I understand, Representative Wisnett, you're working on a dash three or maybe four?
Yes, sir.
So, and I know that Pacific Corps, the PUC, and the Treasurer's Office are all in the audience, but not jumping up to testify at this point or signed up. I guess I'm not going to ask them to do that at this point either.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Again, committee members, they're here. If you have questions to help expedite this, if we can get an agreement through the work group, if you have any questions with the Treasurer's Office, PUC, or...
Maybe I could have the Treasurer's Office come up just for a second, because I do have one question for him. Good morning again, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Certainly for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer.
Mr. Salvaggio, does the Treasurer's Office need a bill to invest these funds in a different different kind of investment that maybe provides a different rate of return?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the short answer is yes, because the current law, as I understand it, has the PUC directing the funds to a private institution, or I don't have it in front of me, I'm afraid, but I believe it's a entity of the federal government, or
it's Wells Fargo. It's Wells Fargo.
The proper statutory structure for allowing the Treasury to invest these funds is to create a fund within the Treasury, though distinct from the general fund, and simply turn that over to the Treasurer's powers under ORS 293, which provides broad authority to work with the PUC, determine what kind of risk, return, and liquidity profile would be appropriate, and invest the monies accordingly.
Answers my question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, also in our work group, we've talked about the fact that there could be a need for some of that money in shorter terms, so we've talked about splitting the money up so it wouldn't all be in one pot, and I think that's what we're working towards, because there could be money for more studies or things like that would be needed in a shorter time, so we'd look at different time limits for the investments.
Absolutely, and Mr. Co-Chair, it's members of the committee, for the record, In making that decision, the Treasury would be considering, with the PUC's input, what kind of liquidity profile would be needed, and we could adjust that accordingly.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming forward. Not seeing anyone else wishing to testify on the bill, I do note that Richard Whitman was here from the governor's office and signed up in opposition to the bill, but apologize to the governor's office because he evidently had to leave. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3461 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2466. Jan, could you give us a description of House Bill 2466, please?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the bill prohibits sending an unsolicited facsimile to a public body, gives the Attorney General authority to bring action against a violator, punishable by not more than $500 per violation, and it makes sending the unsolicited fax an unlawful trade practice. There are no amendments.
Thank you, and good morning. If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
I would. Good morning, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis, and it's a pleasure to be in your committee this morning. I haven't had a chance to be here yet today, and I appreciate your scheduling these two bills. House Bill 2466 was introduced at the request of a constituent of mine named Lisa Krause, who works at Linus Pauling middle school, and we all have things that bother us in the workplace, little things that get under our skin. One of the things that drives she and many of her colleagues crazy are the large number of unsolicited faxes that are coming into their offices, offering them products, services, and all kinds of things they do not want or need. What bothers them even more is that in that school, service and supply budgets are extremely limited. Teachers are needing to purchase their own paper and supplies and having to watch the waste of public school-funded paper going to print out all of these faxes that are coming in is quite troubling to them. Over the course of 6 weeks, they collected some of the faxes that came to them and mailed them to my office. This is about 6 weeks worth of these faxes, and they are for all kinds of things that you might think useful for a public school. Clean credit, special $49 sign-up, slashed from $175 since 1989, remove bankruptcies, collections, charge-offs, foreclosures, and more. Create your own dream vacation, 200 slots available this week. Lowest rates of the season, your vacation package includes a five days, four nights in Orlando. This one was just interesting to me because it's about how to train people to use seclusion and restraint in schools, including prone restraints, which we have a bill that would ban that in Oregon that we're going to hear in the Education Committee tomorrow. This one, congratulations. I saw the article they published about you. That was a great write-up they did about you, and it's not just any business owner or professional that gets this kind of recognition. Congratulations. And it goes on to say that your newspaper article can be laminated on a mahogany plaque so you can hang it on your wall. I'll make copies for all of you in case you wish to use this service. And perhaps my favorite one to my local public school is, fax us your unwanted faxes. In 2006, the Federal Communication Commission gave fax recipients the right to opt out from receiving faxes in the future. You may see this opt-out notice on the faxes you receive. Many recipients do not take the time to remove faxes or opt out improperly. The EnviroFax Commission is a nonprofit corporation. Its assistance is free. EnviroFax does not sell goods or services and will not contact you, which is why they have sent an unsolicited fax. This apparently is not a problem that occurs just for our public schools. We've had several agencies who claim that this is also a nuisance for them. The state treasurer's office dropped off a couple. They also were quite interesting to the Oregon State Treasurer's office. Does your business need capital in the next few days? We can help. Also some opportunities to travel and be listed in the Yellow Pages.
You might give that one to Ways and Means.
I did. When I saw that one, I thought this was great because the turnaround, it was just a few days. It seemed great. It's a simple bill. It is my understanding that it does need an amendment. It is a little bit overly broad when it speaks about unsolicited faxes. It is not the intention to ban constituents from contacting their state legislature to tell them that they no longer wish to receive unsolicited faxes. We want our constituents to be able to fax those requests to us. Otherwise, this simply in Oregon would say, no, you cannot be a menace, you cannot be a nuisance, you cannot fill up the fax machines of our state agencies with these unsolicited faxes. And I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Representative, thanks for bringing the bill. I know private fax machines that get loaded with this stuff. Can we expand this to stop it, to make it for any business that doesn't want to get faxes?
Representative Cameron, co-chairs Holvey and Wisnett, I would be very open to doing that. I think what is true in this fax us our unwanted faxes, businesses, agencies, they all do have the right to kind of do a federal opt-out. It's very difficult to do it. This would provide an extra layer of protection in Oregon so you don't see these same faxes coming over and over again, and there would be a hook, and that would help. It would help our private businesses. It would help our agencies as well.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions for you, and I do note that the relating to clause, I believe, would allow us to put private folks into this bill if we decided to do that.
Let's do it. It's good enough for the government. It's good enough for business.
Thank you very much. for your testimony on this. I don't know what your calendar looks like. Would you like to go ahead and testify on your other bill before we hear other testimony on this?
Or? I would enjoy the other testimony on this, and I'm happy to wait, if that is okay with you.
That is perfectly fine. So up next, I have Ted Campbell.
Do I fax this again?
Yeah, ridiculous.
Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairs and committee members, my name is Ted Campbell. I'm a citizen of Salem and a voter. I've spent the last 30 years in the military defending that pamphlet I gave you. It's one of the two most important books ever written, one being the Bible and one being the Constitution of the United States. The First Amendment guarantees us the right of free speech. I know fax machines weren't there when they wrote that, but it would probably be included now. I would support a no fax list like we have a no call list for people. But if we do this in public, they say public agencies or public bodies, that would include the legislatures and that. And people are sending you faxes all the time, as I'm sure you're aware, after the latest flurry of faxes you've got on the education program. If we put a stop to this way, people will have to be calling into your offices and your administrators will have to take dictation and put it in the file some way. We need to keep the faxes open to people. There is a don't fax me anymore button at the bottom of all these faxes if people use it. Or the state could come up with a no-fax list. But it's, again, if you limit it just to private business, if you say public agencies, then it does mean the state legislature and the governor's office and all public offices. And the other thing is, if they're going to do away with the fax machines to public agencies, they need to have a 1-800 number. Almost every agency in the state has a 1-800 number except the legislature, and we haven't figured out why that isn't, you know, so people from in this area have no problem calling without paying a long-distance fee, but people in Baker, Oregon or that, if they want to call over here, have to pay a long-distance fee, and there's a lot of agencies out there now that are giving free faxes to people. I know FAIR does it, and AFP is starting to do that to allow them to send faxes free, and they'll pick up the tab for it. So I'm against this as it's written. Are there any questions? Yes.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you be okay with it as amended? I believe Representative Gelser said that she's got an amendment coming that talks about excluding the legislature and excluding public comment when it seems like it's the amendment is specific to the unsolicited commercial.
Right, but I would be, but I mean, public agencies, I mean, if you want to talk to or send a fax to ODOT because you got holes in front of your house on the road, they should be able to fax that or, like I say, have a way of communicating with them. Because they say it's costing paper. Well, if they have to write you a letter, it's going to cost the taxpayer paper. Either way, the taxpayer is paying for the paper.
Certainly. So if that exclusion were available, if that were in the amendment, then you'd be okay with it?
I would favor it. I still think the best way is a no-fax list.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
I had a quick question. That was, you said, is AFP a company? Who's AFP?
No. I'm just saying I am a member of AFP, and I've read some stuff that they're going to start offering free faxes like FAIR.
I was just asking what you mean. What's AFP?
It's All Americans for Prosperity.
Oh, political group, not a company, but got it. Advocacy group. Cover the questions.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you. What if it were to say advertise goods or services?
I have no problem with that.
I mean, because really, I mean, I get what you're saying. You want to be able to have any citizen, and we want to be able to have any citizen have their right to express, you know, their opinions and their questions and their comments.
Right.
And I think that's what you're getting at. But what if we could say, and I don't know that we can, but what if it were amended to say, could not advertise goods or services, because the majority of those faxes that we just saw were somewhat ridiculous. And,
right.
And as a business owner, I don't want my employees having to retrieve faxes all day, and I don't necessarily want my staff to do so either.
Right. If it excluded goods and services, unless you have requested something from them,
sure.
You know, as a bid or something like that, I have no problem with that.
Okay, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Doesn't look like it.
Okay. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you very much for testifying today. No one else is signed up to testify on House Bill 2466, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2466. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2938.
Jan, would you like to read a brief description of House Bill 2938?
Chairs, committee members, House Bill 2938 requires public bodies to use only photocopiers and scanners that they own for purpose of making copies that contain personal information. It requires the public bodies to develop and implement policies for removing that information from the electronic storage device before they sell it, donate it, recycle, or dispose of it. It requires businesses to develop and implement policies for removing digital information from photocopiers and scanners that are used by the public for a fee, and requires the businesses to post a notice for the public to see stating that the information copied or scanned can be stored on that machine and the public can receive a copy of their policy. Provides that a violation is an unlawful trade practice. The bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and there's no amendment before you.
Thank you. Good morning again. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Okay, good morning, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. I'm still Sarah Gelser from Corvallis State Representative. House Bill 2938 is the seed of this bill actually started in the 2009 legislative session, and those of you on the Judiciary Committee may remember this in a different form. We were talking about when victims of rape and sexual assault go through sexual assault examinations, and there are photographs that are taken, and we were talking about how do you protect those very personal photographs that can be very embarrassing to an individual. And we had talked about storing those in some sort of a secure facility and making sure that any photocopies of those photos or records were made in a secure facility. One of the concerns that had been raised was that in some parts of the state there are not photocopiers of the quality available in district attorney's offices and law enforcement offices to be able to make those photocopies there. So they were being made at places like Kinko's and Federal Express. One of the problems with that, besides the obvious ones that you would think of, is with the advance of technology, those images actually get stored many times within the hard drive of that photocopier. That legislation did not move forward, but I remain interested in this issue of all of the personal things that we are photocopying onto photocopiers. This isn't just true for rape exams. It's true for child welfare examinations or child welfare investigations, for information that is at the Oregon Department of Revenue, for information that's at the insurance division. Our state computers, scanners, and photocopiers store enormous amounts of personally identifiable information. In the midst of studying all of this, there was a study that came out. There was an investigation, and an organization had gone out to used office equipment warehouse to just purchase some secondhand machines. They went and purchased them, five of them randomly, and went and examined the hard drives in these machines. And what they found within them were records with personally identifiable information about sex crime investigations from a law enforcement agency, tax records from a tax organization, child welfare records from a child welfare office. So what this legislation talks about is ensuring that, first of all, when you're doing those rape exam photocopies or child welfare investigation photocopies, you're doing those on a machine that is controlled by the public body rather than taking that to a commercial entity, so you can protect the privacy of those that are involved in that situation. And it also requires that each agency in the state of Oregon has a policy and a plan for how they completely wipe the memory of a computer or a scanner or a photocopier before they dispose of that machine, whether that's donation to another agency, donation to a nonprofit, it goes to the state surplus sale. In terms of commercial vendors, what the intent of this bill is, and I'm happy to amend it if this doesn't doesn't quite get there is simply to make sure that consumers are aware that when they're going and photocopying their medical records or their tax returns or their child custody agreement at their local Kinko's, that there is a little note in that photocopy area that makes sure that people are aware that the privacy of that information there cannot be guaranteed and that they can access what the safe storage policy is of that business. It does not require them to do anything specific in regards to what they do with that information, simply to make sure that consumers are aware that when there are devices that do store that information internally to the device. So this bill really is about the protection of identifiable information. My priority in it really is those personal records that are handled by public agencies, particularly those that are handled by law enforcement, child welfare, and the Department of Revenue. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee? Representative Sheehan.
Does this sort of, I would think this sort of privacy policy would exist at Kinko's. I went in recently and I think I saw a disclosure of some sort hanging above one of the copy machines. Are you aware of anything that maybe Kinko's does that, but someone else may not?
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, Representative Sheehan, I do believe that there are some entities that are already doing this. This would just ensure that everyone was aware. I think it's an issue that people are starting to become more aware of. It's not unusual that technology gets ahead of us in terms of our thinking about our privacy. I think that's something that Oregonians, really anyone in the world, we've kind of lost that sense of privacy. We all have everything on Facebook every day anyway, but probably none of us would intend to put our medical photographs out for anyone's inspection.
Sure. And a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
And so the bill would make the disclosure of, on a private business would have to do a disclosure, but they wouldn't be bound by the mechanism to destroy the record like the public agencies would. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Sheehan, that is correct. The only requirement for businesses is the disclosure.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Not seeing any at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Up next, I have Kevin Christensen and Peter Dressler. Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett. Not here on the FDIC this time. So I am here as part of the Oregon Bankers Association with respect to our lease folks who do a lot of leasing. I'd note that there are some real laudable objectives, ensuring protection of personal data for citizens by state governments that are contemplated with respect to the legislation, but like so many other things, the devil is in the details. I'm going to make a couple of quick points, just some technical concerns that we have, and then I want to turn this over to Peter Dressler of Pacific Automation, who can speak to the technology aspects, I think some of which was raised in the prior testimony. Couple just big points that we would like to bring home. With respect to Section 1, Section 3, we do have concerns that the broad scope of the provision, basically a public body may use only photocopiers and scanners that are owned by the public policy, or rather the public body. The ramifications that it could severely impact the government lease finance marketplace and dry it up. We do have folks that are several of our institutions who do leasing to public entities, and the impact of that would, to in large part, probably dry up and cost a lot of business that our folks do. In addition, we have some concerns with respect to putting additional obligations, and this is more along the lines, at least some of the banks have reported to me, that there are concerns that they could, the leasing entity, again, we're the folks who provide the financing, could be brought into some of these responsibilities as a safeguard, and if they're not implemented, could face liability under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which is also incorporated with respect to this measure. So there are concerns. The analogy that at least one of my banks says is, you know, it's kind of like a lease on a car. the bank is lesser, has a stake in the vehicle insofar as it's something that they're looking to see payment on. However, if the lessee, the person who rented the car, gets in a crash, they're not the ones, the financing company isn't the ones who's ultimately responsible, and at least some of our banks have indicated that the breadth of the bill itself could capture them and, again, expose them to potential liability. One note, and I'll turn it over after this to Mr. Dressler, and that is this. With respect, I think there was a question from Representative Sheehan concerning whether or not the governmental entity would have any obligation with respect to this. And as I'm reading Section 2, Subsection 1, it provides that any business that offers photocopies or scanners for use by the public for a fee must develop and implement policies on removal of digital data. So as I'm reading it, there it's not just a posted notice. There is an implementation portion of that provision as well. So we do have concerns with the legislation, and with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Dressler.
Thank you. Co-chair, members of the committee, I'm Peter Dressler, a branch manager with Pacific Office Automation, headquartered in Beaverton, Oregon, and I'm here to speak in opposition to House Bill 2938. I've had the good fortune to be employed by Pacific for over 25 years, and we're the largest independent copier dealership in the United States. We're a locally owned Oregon corporation. We employ 300 people in the state of Oregon, 610 people company-wide. The owner and founder of our company, who lives in Oregon, has steadfastly refused to sell out to any of the out-of-state holding companies or foreign-based copier manufacturers who have direct sales operations in this country. I believe this bill is before the committee because of publicity that was begun by a CBS News story. The evening news segment chronicled an individual who purchased four used copier machines from a New Jersey warehouse and proceeded to extract sensitive information off the hard disk drives of those machines. The stated message of the story that today's copiers are, and I quote, storing an image of every document copied, scanned, or emailed by the machine. This news story has caused a lot of heartburn for a lot of people in our industry and business people as a whole. The story was broadcast by This story, as broadcast by CBS, was misleading and misrepresented the facts about what is stored on the memory of a copier machine. After the story ran and my phone started to ring with calls from concerned customers, I did two things. First, I contacted our manufacturers for clarification on how images are managed by the equipment that we sell and service. And second, I asked one of my field network technicians to replicate the exact steps detailed in the CBS story on three different makes of copiers. He came up with very different results. Our results were backed up by the engineers from the manufacturers of the equipment that we tested. Simply stated, because of the features of the current copier equipment, images are left stored on hard disk drives of today's copiers only if you use the copier as an electronic filing cabinet. By year's end, all models going forward, or let me explain why this legislation is not necessary. By year's end, all models going forward from our major manufacturers will have encryption built in, as well as the ability to push a button at the end of equipment life before the copier leaves your office, thereby erasing any sensitive data from the hard disk drive. In closing, if you remember one thing, the common office multifunction copier today doesn't leave behind latent images when copying, scanning to email, or printing. And today's machines have easy ways for end users to erase any other information with an encryption technology now standard on copiers that automatically erases what was once stored in memory. We don't believe this technology, offered a standard feature to erase privacy data from copiers, should confuse end users by a state law. Thank you for allowing me this time to address the committee, and I'd welcome any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Sheehan.
Would either of you object to Section 2.1 being removed from this? If the actual, because I share a concern about the implement. I didn't see that until after the first testimony. Implement policies on removal of digital information. If that were taken out from the private the portion of this, would you be okay with the bill?
Representative Sheehan, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, we would still retain objections with other portions of the bill and its impact.
Thank you. Just Representative Clem.
So you were just talking about both encryption and some process to remove. So I don't know the way copiers, are set up. Or is it like a normal hard drive essentially in there where it's got platters, and if you really want to erase, not encrypt, but erase, you've got to do low-level formatting, zeros and ones to every single byte and sector on the drive, you know, seven passes to meet the DoD standard of removal. Is that what you're talking about? It's already, you push a button and that happens?
Thanks for the question, co-chair and committee. If you want to do it toward the DoD standard, you have seven passes. Number one, it takes about 8 hours to do that per machine. And, you know, if you have one technician with one piece of equipment being able to, you know, to do that drive, you can, one guy can do 10 hard drives a week. That's something that we do offer as a service, you know, to our clients that want that. We'll also take the drive out of the machine and
destroy it.
Well, we'll hand it to them, and we'll charge them a fee for putting a new drive in the machine, and a lot of times we'll have to, you know, put the operating system back on the drive so the machine's operating when we return it to the lease company, if that's the situation. And that's about a $350, $360 transaction. You know, it takes several hours to do that. My concern, if I can continue here, my concern with this is, you know, if we make the guy in Mitchell, Oregon, put a sign up on his wall, you know, that might keep 30% of people from even using the copier machine because they're afraid of their data, you know, falling into the wrong hands. And really, a standard copier doesn't work that way. But if we scare off 30% of the people, you know, the guy that has a copier in the lobby of his store isn't making any money on that copier machine. That's a service that he provides, and he's losing money on it probably. And if he's going to lose 30% more money on it, he may just elect not to have it there. And I can tell you, I was lucky enough to take a motorcycle trip across the state of Oregon a year ago, and I was in Prineville, and I had to help my daughter. I had to co-sign on a lease for an apartment for a summer job in Astoria, and I was able to do that from a little copy shop, you know, in Prineville. And, you know, if that place hadn't have been there, I don't know where I would have gone to be. You know, how would people do business out in these smaller towns if it's so restrictive that people can't have that equipment on site?
And, Mr. Chair,
follow up.
And so I'm sorry, I had another meeting, and so I'm not even sure exactly who you are representing here, but are you mostly worried about copiers? Because it looks to me like the bill applies to, you know, a variety of digital data storage devices, really any kind of computers or anything that the state may be using.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisdom, Representative Clem, I think it extends beyond just copiers, and I think it goes to one of the initial points with respect to at least photocopiers and scanners, I think, as I'm looking at subsection 3. But again, our concern from a financing point of view is that's taking a substantial hit in government leasing. So
I might just make a comment. Yeah, this is what I do for a living as well, IT work, and we have one of my partners that I buy all my stuff from. For a while, he was running the state's disposal of you know, the agencies would kick it over to DAS, and then there would be an in-house deal, and that happened because he was buying lots of computers and then looking at the drives and getting every single server in every bar who had a liquor license, or he was getting all their social security numbers, everything right off of the bulk computer sale. So he went to DAS and said, this is not, I'm sure, what you are thinking is happening to this data. It's just ending up being sold on the weekends, you know, down in Salem here on State Street. So they said, oh, wow, can you help us? So he made a response to their RFP along with other people, I assume. He ended up winning the contract and doing it for a number of years until it was assumed by the Garten Services, I think, has it now. It was essentially shifted away under the Products for Disabilities products. Anyway, the law that allows people with disabilities to do this work, they now have the contract. And I can tell you, having used a lot of the software to recover data myself, it is expensive to really get rid of it. I just destroy the hard drive. Because, I mean, I have retrieved, people think they have formatted and reloaded their drives, and I have retrieved things seven reloads before because it is, there's software that you can download on the internet and do it, and it'll show you what's available, and then you pay to get it back. But I mean, I have found data from years before that people thought was long gone, and it's not long gone. So I think the intent of the bill is pretty good. It is not cheap, though, to really for sure get rid of it. I mean, it does require, I would say, almost destruction. Personally, low-level formatting, 7 passes would probably do it, but I don't ever even trust my own computers. I take the hard drive out and keep it, or destroy it.
Thank you for that in-depth view of the bill. I think the point, I think, that is made is that there is personal information in many of the of these pieces of equipment, and how do we protect people's privacy from that information being used by someone it's not intended for. And I think that's a good aim. I don't know if you have a solution to that, other than the one that Representative Clem just offered.
I'll say thank you, Co-Chair. The one thing that we found, and I think the fear that the national media has put in people, and we've found it to be inaccurate. The fear is when you go make a copy, there's an image of that copy, you know, left on the hard drive of the copier, and that's not accurate. You can, today's copier machine, you can go up, you know, if I wanted to throw this out but keep all the information, I could scan this to the hard drive of the machine and be able to go back and access that later. But that's a different issue. If the issue is just protecting the guy that wants to make the copy in the, you know, the Mount Vernon General Store or wherever that is of his tax records, that's not going to be left on the memory of that copier machine.
Granted, you know, that's probably not all machines store stuff, but some do. And I think that's sort of what we're trying to get at here. I appreciate your testimony, and I appreciate your concerns as well. Representative Gelser, did you wish to make any other comments on this bill?
Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, I do note, I forgot, I have one other testifier, too, but go ahead.
Okay, thank you again, Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, for the record, Sarah Gelser, State Representative from Corvallis. In response to Representative Sheehan's comment, I was making the same note in the back. I would be very happy to amend out subsection 1 of 2 in terms of the requirement of the development of the policy. And to be clear, while I do think that it would be good policy for consumers to be aware that there's the potential for information to be stored in a commercial machine, the real concern that drives this bill are our publicly owned machines, and it's for the precise reasons that Representative Clem was raising. Those images are still there. We are talking about rape exam photos, child abuse investigations, interrogations, and interviews. We are talking about tax records and tax disputes and protected health information that's going back through the Oregon Health Plan. I believe that we have an obligation as a state to protect the very, very private information of our citizens, to make sure that we are not transferring that information inadvertently to another agency or to who knows who through our surplus sales. And certainly taking out the hard drive or destroying the hard drive, if that is the policy that is developed by that agency, would comply with this legislation. DAS may choose that there are different standards for different agencies depending on the type of information that is generally stored there. But again, I would ask you to think about the type of information that you are photocopying, that you're putting on your hard drive of your computer. Recently had an issue with DHS and a missing flash drive. Lots of personal information. We have to be responsible stewards of it. This bill will help us make sure that we do that, and I am certainly willing to let go of the commercial piece in order to get at that bigger piece.
Thank you. Up next, I have Tim Jocelyn. Almost left you out. You've been sitting here patiently, I think, since the beginning of this meeting. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Jocelyn. I'm a return-to-work consultant at Safe Corporation. And I'm here just to bring your attention a point that's already been raised by Mr. Christensen and Mr. Dressler regarding the leased machines that businesses use. We at Safe Corporation do not own all of our copiers, and so I would bring your attention to Section 1, Subsection 3 of the bill, where it says that a public body may only use photocopiers and scanners owned by the public body. And we would just suggest that the bill be amended to permit the use of leased equipment when the terms of the lease require the removal of personal information at the end of the lease.
Thank you. I appreciate that input. Representative Smith.
I want to make sure I understand your feedback. You're saying you want to exempt leased equipment, or you want to make sure leased equipment follows the same standards as owned equipment?
It follows the same standards, just that it's included in there. Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else want to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2938. I believe we're done. Any other items of business?
Do you want to ask any members to attend this? It's a big meeting tomorrow.
What time, Representative Wisnett, what time is that meeting on House Bill 3461?
We cannot have a quorum present.
Oh, we can't. Okay.
You can have four people on.
I think it's 10:30 today, Chair.
So if members wish to attend that meeting, please check with
my office, and I'll tell you where it
is. Representative Wisnett, so we are cognizant of our quorum rules. Thank you for that invite. 10:30, right?
I think it's what they announced.
All right. With that, I'm going to close.
At 10:30.
I already closed the hearing on the bill. So I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection.